So I wanted to talk on a theme, on a talk that I talked about on a Monday, a few Mondays ago, kind of similar talk. I apologize for those people who were there on that Monday. I don't usually don't like to give the same talk kind of twice, so I feel apologetic. But I like this topic, and I thought I'd like to do it again, and I thought it might be useful for any of you to hear this talk, because it has to do with the nature of mindfulness, which is the core practice that we do here at IMC, the insight meditation or the mindfulness practice. And the question is, what is mindfulness? Is an interesting one. To the uninitiated, it might seem strange and kind of perplexing, or it might seem very obvious that mindfulness is just being attentive, paying attention. To kind of warm you up to why this might be a little bit interesting topic, is I've been a mindfulness teacher for some 15 years, and I'm not sure what it is. What do you think of that? Hopefully you'll stay the rest of the talk. and part of the reason is that I'm not so sure what it is that in the Buddhist tradition, there are actually different definitions of mindfulness, different meanings of it, in different contexts. So I want to give some of the background for it. I think of it as one of the great crown jewels of Buddhist practice. There's a variety of kind of jewels in the crown of Buddhism, if you allow that analogy. And mindfulness is one of the key ones. And almost all Buddhist traditions have a very honored place for the practice of mindfulness, for the mental functioning we call mindfulness. And some traditions use the word explicitly, mindfulness, or the Pali or Sanskrit equivalents, Chinese equivalents. And some traditions are more implicit, that mindfulness is really important. The word mindfulness in Pali is sati, S-A-T-I, and in Sanskrit is smriti. And when it translated into kind of Japanese, Chinese, kind of Japanese pronunciation of Chinese characters, it's nen. I think it's nien in Chinese. And it is, and the word sati in Pali and also smriti has a range of meanings. And the best way of probably translating into English is not using the word mindfulness, but by the expression to keep in mind. Mindfulness is the mental functioning, or sati is the mental functioning that helps us to keep something in mind. And when we use that English expression, keep it in mind, we can mean a variety of different things. You can keep in mind your shopping list. Oh no, I forgot about my to-do list, or something, and you keep it in mind. Or you can keep in mind a poem that you've memorized. So it has the connotations of to remember or to memorize. You can keep in mind values that are important for you. I remember that being honest is really important. I kept that in mind when I went into that very difficult meeting. And I always kind of relied on being honest in that situation. So you kept that in mind, to keep it in mind. Also to keep in mind the present moment is kind of, that's closer to what we mean by mindfulness and mindfulness meditation. To be, have a presence of mind where we're aware of what's happening in the present while it's happening. So we keep the present moment in mind as part of the meaning. So sati has a range of meanings that we could use, at least that we use the expression keep in mind in English. It's defined sometimes in the negative in the tradition as non-forgetfulness. So we don't forget about the present moment. We don't forget about, something we've memorized. We don't forget about our values or we don't forget about our priorities or what's really important for us. The non-forgetfulness, that capacity of the mind not to forget what's important, is partly what mindfulness is. In English, we have the expression presence of mind, and it's very closely akin to that. And probably in the mindfulness practice we do, sati has the meaning of developing a presence of mind, where you're really in the present moment with a certain capacity to be aware of what's happening in the present. I think when we have a presence of mind, either clearly or indirectly, we know that we're present. You really clearly have a strong presence of mind, a really strong sense of presence. Here I am, I'm paying attention, I'm aware. Then you're so aware that you know that you're aware. As opposed to a presence, a kind of awareness of what's going on, and you're not so aware of what's going on. You're not aware that you're aware while you're doing it. A crazy person, someone who's deranged perhaps, could be quite aware of his or her environment, of what's going on, or could be aware of a lot of different things. But there might not be much presence of mind, might not be some awareness of him or herself being aware, awareness of what one is doing, what one is thinking, and what one impact is in the world around one. So when there's a strong presence of mind, it's kind of like you're taking in a lot of different information of what's happening in the present moment while it's happening. And you're kind of aware that, you kind of know that you're doing it. There's kind of a sense, yes, this is what's happening right now, I'm really here and present. In the Buddhist tradition, it says that mindfulness is needed in every situation, just like salt is needed in every curry. And we would say in every soup or something. You don't have too much of it, they say, at least the salt. But they say in the Buddhist tradition, you can never have too much mindfulness. It also points out, the Buddhist tradition, that mindfulness, this capacity of non-forgetfulness, of presence of mind, of keeping things in mind, is a faculty that we all have. It's a capacity or potential we all have, and as a faculty, it's something that can be developed. And so you think of it like a muscle, and you can develop that capacity to be present, to be mindful, to be aware, to hold things in mind. And along that line, one of the very classically important practices in Buddhism has been to memorize. And to memorize Buddhist texts, for example, Buddhist teachings. And part of the historical value of it is that in the old days they didn't have writing. So the only way that Buddhist teachings were preserved was people memorized them. And they had a very elaborate way of memorizing that kept the accuracy of it down through the centuries. But even nowadays, and you go to Thailand and places here in this country, you find Buddhist practitioners who are memorizing various things, sometimes short things, sometimes long things. It's interesting that in 1954, they had one of the very rare, what's called Buddhist councils, where all the different representatives from all the different kind of Theravada and Buddhist countries, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, I think probably Cambodia, maybe Vietnam, Laos, they had this big convention, bringing them all together for the first time in maybe 2,000 years, all these different groups and different countries and different orders of Buddhism in the Southeast Asian tradition. And they called a meeting in Burma, and a lot of countries didn't want to send any representatives to this meeting unless the Burmese could prove that they had someone, a monk, in their country who had memorized the entire Buddhist canon. And until they could prove that, until they had that, it didn't make any sense to show up. The value of memorization was so high, and the Buddhist canon is huge. And some of the most respected monks in Burma to this day are those who have been able to memorize the whole canon. You can go to Burma and there's a couple of these still alive, the people, and you just tell them, what about page, so-and-so, or, this encyclopedic memory, photographic memory, I guess, and they just remember it all. But even for people who have very poor memorization ability, it's a faculty that can be developed, strengthen our ability to memorize. And one of the reasons it's important for mindfulness students is that the faculty to memorize something is very closely connected to the faculty to be mindful in the present moment. The idea to keep something in mind, whether it's some text that you've memorized, or to keep the present moment in mind, it's kind of similar muscles being used in the mind. And so the stronger your ability to memorize something, the stronger your ability to stay present, like, for example, when you're doing meditation. So it's considered that an aid to developing a meditative mind, the strength of memorization. Another definition of mindfulness is that it's the not floating away. So the mind, when it's paying attention to something, it's not liable just to float away casually or you know, against your will. The mind will stay rooted in what you want to pay attention to. Keep focused. Keep in mind what you want to keep focused on. The opposite of mindfulness in the tradition is a word that's called, in Pali is called pamada, and it means, usually translated into English as heedfulness, heedlessness, I'm sorry, heedlessness, or negligence, a mind which is not heedful or not vigilant about what's going on in the present moment. A mind which is negligent or heedless is one that's going to make a lot of mistakes, both ethical mistakes and other kind of mistakes. If you're not heedful for your speech, then you might say something you later regret. So mindfulness has this capacity then of having enough presence of mind to be tracking what's happening in the present moment to help us with our ethical decisions in our life, the choices we make. The most common, I believe the most common reason or justification given in the West for practicing mindfulness is that mindfulness practice puts us in the present moment. And the present moment is a wonderful place to live, to be. And a lot of the wonderful things in life that we can experience only can be experienced when we're in the present to experience them. A lot of the joy, a lot of love, a friendship, sense of peace. A lot of things we tend to value a lot. You have to be in the present to experience them. And you increase your opportunity to have those wonderful qualities the more you are in the present moment. The less you're in the present moment, the less things like joy and friendship and love and peace and these wonderful qualities have a chance to be present for you. So you increase the possibility of wonderful things happening if you're in the present moment. If nothing else, we increase the value of living in a much more direct way, a sense of directness in our experience, or aliveness in our experience, that we really feel and sense and live in a very direct, immediate way. And it's very easy to kind of think for that way, or kind of be busy with life and running along and thinking everything is fine. And then something happens, and we realize, actually, our life is not so present or so vivid. We're distracted a lot, we're preoccupied a lot, we're not really noticing what's going on around us. When I was in Japan, after being in the monastery, I was in the monastery, and Zen monastery, and I would ask some of the monks there why they became Zen monks. And there was one monk who had been, once he'd grown up, he'd kind of dropped out, kind of hippie kind of guy, and had gone and lived on a farm for 7 years, a natural kind of organic farm in Japan. And he said, after living there for 7 years, I woke up one morning and looked around and I realized that I didn't know the trees were green. And that's when I decided to go into the Zen monastery so I could realize the trees were green. Now, you know, of course he knew the trees were green, but I think what he was saying there was he was not really present. He was so preoccupied or caught in his world or his attachments and everything that he couldn't really see clearly something as simple as the nature of the trees, and really be close and intimate with it, or really hear for it. So he entered the Zen monastery in order to have that kind of presence and immediacy in his experience. So that greater sense of aliveness and directness comes from being present. Some people find it deeply satisfying to really sense and feel our life as it actually is, as opposed to experiencing life through our concepts or distractions or a virtual reality the mind tends to create. Some people would rather not be present because the life as it's directly lived also has suffering as part of it. And so we'd rather not notice our suffering, other people's suffering. But part of the value of developing mindfulness of the present moment is mindfulness is also quite healing. The directness and the immediacy of opening up and experiencing things as they are, to see things truthfully, is, many traditions point, is a very healing phenomenon. It helps the mind a lot, it helps our society a lot, our interpersonal relationships a lot, if we begin entering it in a very honest and direct way, as is actually being lived in the moment. The analogy that I used when I gave this talk before, which no one told me was a good analogy, but I'll take my chances again, of someone who lives their whole born into a house and never leaves, and they have this great big television screen, 54-inch television screen, flat screen up against the wall in the living room. Television in every room, in the bathroom, in the kitchen, everywhere, right? And they have cable. And so they grow up in this house, and windows, blinds are closed, and they don't know anything about the outside world. But the world inside is pretty vivid and varied, and pretty entertaining. And if you get bored with one channel, you turn to another channel. And there's 600 channels on cable, I've been told. So, it's great variety. How could anybody ever get bored? And it's really great. The person has a great life watching television. And then at some point, electricity goes out. And the person kind of wonders about this piece of wood there with a knob on it. And so turns the knob and the door opens up and the person goes out. And the person recognizes a little bit, what's out there because it's seen those kinds of things on television, trees and flowers and roads and all that. But the person goes out into the street and suddenly there's a three-dimensional world that the person wasn't aware of before. And there's the wind and sounds and, all the smells and all the stuff that becomes much more alive and vivid. And there are times when people do mindfulness practice that the world suddenly can open up in this almost the same way. Wow, I didn't realize that, I was living kind of in truncated awareness, so, not so fully present for the richness of this life as it's being lived. I've been in situations where I've seen a candy wrapper on the ground and just been in awe. It's been the most beautiful thing in the world. Wow, look at it, silver, it's glittering, it's great. Maybe that sounds like a silly justification for being mindful, but the way kind of the world kind of opens up and kind of glitters when we kind of develop the capacity to keep the present moment in mind, to really be present and not to have the filters of our fears and preoccupations, our ambitions in the way of really seeing. Another definition the tradition gives for mindfulness, again, a negative definition, is that it's non-superficiality. It's a mind which is not superficial about our experience, but actually has some depth of penetration, depth of seeing of our experiences actually is. And also defines it as non-obliviousness. Not being oblivious to what's going on. Now, another way of kind of an angle for looking at mindfulness a little bit is to understand how mindfulness functions together with other faculties that we have in our mind. There's a list in Buddhism called the five faculties, five capacities we all have. It's not something that's strange or mystical, just all things we have. And these mindfulness works with each of these other four. Mindfulness is one of the five, so mindfulness works with the other four. It works with what's often called faith, which maybe seems a little bit odd to call that a faculty. I like the word confidence, and confidence certainly is a faculty we all have, and the presence of confidence makes a big difference in our lives, and the absence of it also. And as a kind of source of confidence or faith, connected with confidence and faith, mindfulness is understood to be a refuge. It's a place where Buddhists take refuge. Taking refuge is kind of a very strong expression of faith in Buddhism, or confidence. It's where we go for protection, where we go for safety, where we go for a sense of deep truth and value, deepest kind of values of the spiritual life. It's where we go for refuge in. And mindfulness is understood as a place of refuge. It's not something that's abstract or dry or empty. But for Buddhists, it's a place that's understood to be very rich. Kind of like maybe how someone is, deeply, I apologize for the limited example, but, has really deep, deep faith as a Catholic. And they go into a Catholic cathedral, they feel at home. Wow, yes, this is great. We're up here, I feel really comfortable here, this is a sense of sacredness that I have. Or a Buddhist, going to a Buddhist temple or something. The sense of mindfulness has that power for people who have a sense of it, that it's a refuge, a place of coming home, it's a sacred kind of abode, that, oh yes, here I am. This is a place of sacredness, of safety, of connection, that which is most holy or most valuable for me. So mindfulness connected to faith has very deep meaning as a faculty of mind. Partly connected to faith or confidence is when mindfulness is connected to having the big picture of what is possible, a big context for mindfulness itself. If we really understand how mindfulness functions to lead towards liberation, to lead to deepening of love or compassion, to lead to spiritual development, then their sense of confidence and joy, perhaps, with the practice of mindfulness itself. It's not just something dry, but something inspiring, mindfulness. The other faculty that's connected to is effort. Effort or engagement or applying oneself. In our effort, there's something that can wane and wax. We can have really good effort when we're really awake and energized, and not so good effort if we're tired. We can develop our capacity for effort, and we can have greater and greater capacity for effort if we build ourselves up, if we kind of exercise ourselves. Just like if we go running, the first, you know, days or weeks of doing exercise regime, we don't go very far. The effort is not there in the right way. But as we keep doing it, we develop more and more, you know, we condition ourselves, and more effort is there. When mindfulness is connected to effort, we do something in relationship to being mindful. Mindfulness puts us in the present moment, and then, it gives us a choice of how we respond to what's happening in the present moment. And so we have to apply effort then in exercising that choice. So, for example, if someone gets angry with you, there's a variety of choices you have of how to respond to that person. You could, for example, punch the person out. Generally, when people do that, there isn't much presence of mind involved before punching the person out. If there's a presence of mind, you know, I'm angry, I'm frustrated, this person being angry with me, and you're aware, quite aware of your reactions and your feelings, there can be some space in the mind around that so it doesn't become reactive immediately. And then we can apply effort to leave alone our reactivity. Okay, I'm not going to act on that impulse in my arm. Or we can make effort and say, oh, you know, maybe there's a better way of responding to this person. Maybe I can ask the person, why are you angry? And, you know, so we apply, there's some kind of effort that's applied together that comes out of being mindful of the present moment. The idea of effort here is connected to the idea that Tanisara Bhikkhu teaches, that the mind is made up of many different impulses, many different thoughts and feelings, and you can't have much control to a great extent over what you think and what goes up happens in the mind. Things pop up in the mind. The mind just kind of produces thoughts and ideas and intentions and feelings and all kinds of memories. And to some extent, things just appear. And it doesn't really help much to be critical of that or attack it or feel like judge yourself negatively because you have some terrible thought that pops up. The idea of mindfulness is to be very accepting, very spacious, very open and allowing for what's in the mind. And not feel like it's control what appears in the mind. However, in that the mind has many different impulses, the mind is understood kind of be like a corporate board, where you have all these very opinionated board members, and the chair of the board cannot control what the next board person is going to say. You know, I think we should do this, and I think we should do that, this and that. And they stand up and say what they're going to say. However, before the chair of the board has a veto power. So nothing gets decided over the veto of the chair. So they can have all kinds of crazy ideas of the board, but unless the chair really feels that in favor of it, it's not going to happen. So the same thing in the mind. In a sense, we're the chair of the mind. And we don't have the control over what the mind does, what it pops up in the mind. But we have veto power over it, whether we act on it. We have veto power over whether we engage and indulge in it further. So some fantasy arises, and you're not in control of the fantasy arising. But at some point, if you have a presence of mind, what's going on, you have some choice for whether you chase that fantasy, or do you follow it, get involved in it, or whether you say, no, thank you. You just kind of let it be there, kind of let go of it, in a sense. So effort, is minimally means the effort to let go, or to say, no, not now. So we can stay mindful, so we can stay present and not caught up in what the experience is. If we don't understand the role of effort in meditation practice, then in a sense, we give up our responsibility for our lives. And a very key aspect of Buddhist spirituality is taking responsibility for our reactions, our feelings, what we act, not our feelings, but our, take responsibility for what the mind picks up and holds on to. And then what we act on. Without understanding where our responsibility is, there's no Buddhist spirituality. And taking responsibility requires effort. So mindfulness and effort are very key partners together. Mindfulness that, in this regard, is able to track and see what's going on and have the veto power and kind of leave things alone and be left alone, I like to associate what's called the grandmotherly love, grandmotherly mind. That it's the mind of kind of a grandmother who kind of loves the children, is equanimous around the grandchildren, but doesn't necessarily, knows how to say no, and knows how to say yes, knows how to not stay balanced and not caught in the drama of what the grandchildren all are about. But it is a kind of loving mind. It is said that a person who is mindful has enough presence of mind to be in control enough to respond wisely to what is happening. That somehow, in relationship to being mindful, if you're mindful of what's happening in the present moment, you have some control of responding wisely. You have some choice and ability to do that. One of the paradoxes is people will say, I've done this in my own sitting. My mind wanders away and gets distracted. I notice it, and I'll say to myself, boy, I can't do this mindfulness. This is terrible. I'm a terrible mindfulness practitioner, something like that. And the paradox is that in order to have noticed that the mind wandered away, I had to be mindful at that moment. The moment that I had enough presence of mind to criticize my ability to be mindful, I had enough mindfulness. I might not have had it 2 seconds ago or 5 seconds ago, but in the moment I was criticizing myself, I had it then. You get the paradox? It's kind of like my little thing, someone sitting very quietly, and mind is really serene in meditation, and quiet, and a little whisper in the back of the mind that says, the mind's not thinking right now. And you believe it. So if there's enough presence of mind to criticize your mindfulness practice, it's a paradox, a joke. If there's no need to criticize it anymore. The analogy here, kind of this mindfulness, this kind of point of tracking what's going on and responding wisely, is that of a gatekeeper. In the ancient world, they had these fortified, walled cities, and they'd be a gatekeeper at the gate, and the gatekeeper's job was to watch everyone who came in and out of the city, and deciding who to let in and who to let out, who not to let in, who not to let out. And so mindfulness has a capacity to be at the gates of the mind, in a sense, and watch, oh, here comes an impulse. Well, that's an interesting impulse. It's very kind and nice. I think I'll let that one out. Oh, here comes an impulse to be hateful. Oh, I think that, we can leave that back in the city or whatever. So the mind has this ability to track and to watch and make choices when it has this presence of mind. To apply effort. The next faculty is that of concentration. And concentration is a very important faculty to connect with mindfulness because it gives a continuity to the mindfulness practice. When the mind has developed its capacity to be concentrated, then it's more likely to stay mindful over minutes and over time. When there's very little strength of concentration, strength of focus, you might drop into being mindful or arouse mindfulness for a moment, and then after a little while the mind wanders away, floats away. But when the mind is concentrated, the analogy is like the mind is rooted in the present moment. It's stabilized. The ancient analogy is that of a 20-foot post. That's half of it, 10 feet of it is buried in the ground. And so it's really stable. You can't really push it over at all. When the mind is concentrated, and then it has a strength, the stability, you can't push it around, and the mindfulness is much more likely than to stay in the present moment. The last faculty is that of wisdom or discernment. The Buddha, and if we read the teachings of the Buddha, he didn't really teach what is sometimes called in the West choiceless awareness. He didn't really very often teach just being mindful of things, just arising and passing just freely. But he often talked about that certain things are more useful to pay attention to than other things. That you can make some choice of where you put the mind, where you put your attention. So that there are certain things which are useful or wise to pay attention to, and other things which are maybe not so useful or sometimes counterproductive to pay attention to. So our capacity to keep things in mind also can be used in choosing what we keep in mind, not just simply being present in the present moment in and of itself, but given that we're present, some things are more useful than other things to pay attention to. So, for example, I find it very useful to pay attention to my body. And so I spend a lot of time in my day coming back to my body, checking in with my body, and experiencing the world around me through my body, being embodied. And it's something that's kind of almost second habit now for me, that that I come back into my body and feel my body. And I find that my life is a lot easier and wiser if I'm aware of what's going on in my body. I often check in with my breath. What's going on with my breathing? It's just nice to be there. It kind of helps me be in the present moment. But the breath gives me a lot of information about what's going on. When I get tense about something, I can feel that in my breathing sometimes the first time. And so it teaches me what's going on and how to be more wisely in the present moment. One of the very important qualities that I've learned to pay attention to through practice is the quality of the mind or the heart, or whether it's clinging to something or not clinging, whether it's stuck or not stuck. And there's a sense in the mind when the mind is free or open or loose that's very different than the sense of the mind when it's contracted or constricted or held up or tight. And I find it very useful to track that, what's going on, because I'd rather be free. and so I could just be aware of the sound of the birds and the sunsets and all those things, just whatever's going on. But I find that actually having some choice, and including some things more than other things, helps me stay more present in a wiser way. And this is very much in line with what the Buddha taught. Sometimes the Buddha emphasized certain things are very important to pay attention to sometimes, certain themes. So one of the forms of sati, of mindfulness, is marana sati, mindfulness of death. And so it said it's wise certain times in your life to actually think about death. Think about your death, about the meaning of death, or the nature of death. Keep somehow the idea of death in mind so that to help you live more wisely, to help you maybe clarify what your values are. In many ways, that's considered a very wise thing. If it makes you more morbid, then the Buddha said don't do it, this practice. But if it helps you become freer, then mindfulness of death can be very, very helpful. Another interesting mindfulness practice that the Buddha taught is a mindfulness of the qualities of the Buddha himself or herself. To actually spend some time keeping in mind our sense of the meaning, our sense of the qualities of the heart or the mind of the Buddha. Is the freedom there, the love there, the compassion there, the peace that might be there? And that's considered in tradition a very helpful thing to do. It's inspiring to do that. To have a connection to that. Partly, I feel, as we think about or reflect on the qualities of the Buddha, hopefully what it does, it helps us to understand these qualities in ourselves. So it's kind of a mirror for what's inside of ourselves, and that way inspiring something beautiful within ourselves. So the function of wisdom is to help us understand what right mindfulness is, as opposed to wrong mindfulness. There is a distinction in the tradition. Right mindfulness is one of the Eightfold Paths. So where is it useful to pay attention to in our lives? And along these lines, it's useful to remember what our highest potential is. To remember what's really possible in a human life. We don't have to just kind of skim along the surface of our life. We don't have to kind of just go along with life and just kind of improve the quality a little bit by having a little bit less stress. But it's possible to cultivate some of the deepest potential of peace, of love, of compassion that's available in the human heart. And it's not an easy thing to do. And so it requires a lot of mindfulness, presence of mind, and a lot of remembering that it's really possible and valuable to do that. So that we begin changing, making different choices about how we live our lives. Without keeping in mind and being reminded of our highest potential, it's all too easy to kind of get caught up in the superficial aspects of life. And if we always keep in mind what's important, then we make wiser choices. We stay in touch with what's important. The Buddha said a number of places that the proximate cause for liberation is hearing the Dharma, hearing the teaching. And I think maybe nowadays he would say is maybe also reading about it. Back then they didn't read, didn't have books on the Dharma. But somehow hearing about the Dharma, hearing about spiritual teachings on a regular basis keeps those teachings in mind enough that we begin acting in ways that are in harmony with those values. So mindfulness is much more than stress reduction or even some kind of psychological healing. It can lead us to the deepest levels of inner purification and inner transformation and freedom. Partly because it's the nature of mindfulness itself, in its purity, to be a state of freedom. And I'll leave you with that. So there's a question for you, or an exercise for you. As you go about this week, kind of pay attention to your ability to pay attention. Notice your quality of mindfulness. Notice when you're really sharp and strong. You really feel a strong sense of presence. Notice when it's not so strong. Notice when it's kind of been absent. Notice when it's really strong. See if there's some quality of peace or freedom or tenderness or beauty in that presence of mind in and of itself. Part of the reason why mindfulness has such great transformative power in us is that mindfulness itself has those qualities in itself. Is that fair enough? So the more you develop that mindfulness, the more those qualities of freedom become yours. So keep in mind. So I hope that was clear enough. And I apologize for not keeping in mind that I'm supposed to give a short talk. But perhaps we can take a few minutes so we can exercise the mic. And if you have any questions, just ask. You can pass those mics around. I think it's somewhere on the stage there if you can turn it on.
How does consciousness fit into this?
Well, consciousness is another thing that I don't know what it is. And what do you think it is?
thinking about how mindfulness and consciousness intersect, and consciousness is in a, I think, when we're awake, we're conscious. And I don't know what you think about dreaming, whether that's consciousness or not. I think that's different than mindfulness.
But a crazy person is conscious also.
Right.
Crazy person is not free.
What does the Buddha say about consciousness?
Well, it's a little bit hard. Maybe it should be really easy, but maybe I know too much or read too much, you know, and you know, my mind's been soiled. We have the English word consciousness, and we assume that that's a valid concept, valid, points to something very particular. We all have it. It's really clear. And that there should be an obvious translation into Indian Buddhist language for what consciousness is. But it turns out there isn't. And it's kind of like the human experience. If you think of all human being and human experience as being a pie, different cultures divide up that pie differently. Everybody's human in the same way, perhaps. But they divide up the pie in terms of the language and the descriptions differently. Just like, you know, there's the English measuring system and the metric measuring system. And it's the same distance we measure, but whether it's a kilometer or a mile, you know, we have different ways of dividing up the pie, right? The distance. So we have the word, consciousness in English, and we all think we know what it is. But then you go to take a class in consciousness at Stanford, and you realize it's, you know, 20 different definitions, and you have to ask what the definition is. And you try to find a good correlate with the Buddha had to teach. You find it gets harder and harder to do that. It seems like consciousness should be a really obvious thing. Everybody knows what the conscious is. But it's kind of like trying to touch your own elbow. You know? You know you have an elbow, but you can't quite touch it and know what it is. That's my take. I guess it's not helpful, what I said. you want to try again? Or maybe you want to answer the question. Yes?
Just having this thought that maybe mindfulness is a quality of consciousness. That there are a lot of different qualities to being conscious, and mindfulness is one.
Could be, yes, that's nice. Certainly mindfulness is a quality of, or aspect of the mind. There are many different aspects of the mind. One distinction that maybe can be made is that mindfulness tends to be something that's, more active, and sometimes has an element of choice as part of it. Whereas awareness or alertness, can be something that you kind of carry with you. So mindfulness can kind of kickstart alertness and awareness. And that once, sometimes you can let go of mindfulness to be very alert and aware. But mindfulness has a kind of more active quality than awareness. And so some people talk about resting and awareness, because awareness is not really doing anything, it's the nature of the mind to be aware. So mindfulness is a little bit different than, you know. So mindfulness has a quality of clearly recognizing, clearly knowing what is going on in the present moment. There's a kind of quality of knowing in mindfulness. Awareness, there might not be the same kind of clear, precise recognition of what's happening. And some people have a sense, a very clear sense, that awareness is something that's separate from what is known. And so Buddhists sometimes talk about resting in awareness. Very peaceful and very nice thing to do. But is awareness the same thing as consciousness? And a lot of people in English would like to say they're the same thing. With any kind of situation that you have something that's undesirable or something you don't, is rather than trying to get rid of it, is to understand it first. So use your mindfulness to understand the judging, including to look at it very directly. So turn the mindfulness around and say, oh, I'm being judging here. Okay, what's the nature of this judgment? What's it feel like in my body to be judging? What is it? What are the emotions that are connected to it? What's the quality of the inner voice that's judging? And to really see it and stop for it. And sometimes it's really helpful to talk to friends about it. You know? I have almost judgment, you know. Sometimes just talking about someone else takes sometimes the sting away from it, or the power away from it. So that's one thing, is to look at it very honestly and see what's going on. Another thing to do with judgment is to switch from mindfulness practice to loving kindness practice. And that part of yourself that's judgmental is probably a part that needs some kind of attention and love. And so sometimes to bring loving kindness to that part can be very helpful. In the back there.
There's a question of consciousness, and I remember in the tweet you said one sentence, and you said, well, you don't want to call it mindfulness anymore, you want to call it awakeness, or being awake. And I totally loved this, because mindfulness was always very dry for me, and had an effort, I have to be mindful, and awakeness gives me just much more space, and also includes the mystery of my being, and not understanding really what I am and why it is. So I don't know if you want to say something to this awakeness.
Yeah, sometimes I prefer synonyms to mindfulness rather than the word mindfulness. And one of them that I like is wakefulness. Awakefulness, to be awake to. So rather than be mindful of our experience, to be awake to the experience. And the idea of being awake to our experience has a more of a quality of a spaciousness, of allowance, of acceptance, of openness to it. Of not needing to do anything about it, and just let it be as it actually is, to be awake to the breath, to be awake to this experience. And because sometimes mindfulness does have a quality of effort or force or kind of a different feeling for people than maybe it's useful to have and maybe mindful. So we discover how to be awake to the experience rather than how to be mindful to the experience. That's a nice way of saying. The last one, and then you can speak, but let's give her the mic, and then you can stop after this one.
I know, excuse me, I'm thinking about that discussion about consciousness and wondering, you know, when we think at least the Pali word vijnana and how it's translated often as consciousness. Vijnana? Okay. I'm wondering if maybe even though consciousness in English word is difficult to kind of put our hands on and define clearly, what's your experience of the, what is it, vijnana? Vijnana? I'm going to have to practice that one. Vijnana, what's your experience? And is that, is there a more precise definition or a clearer understanding of that one?
There is a word in Pali, in Sanskrit, called vijnana, which is usually translated, very often translated into English as consciousness. But the scholars who really study carefully what, you know, what the tradition, how it talks about this and what the meaning of this word, mostly point out that that's a kind of sloppy translation of something that has a kind of particular meaning. And they like to point out that the word vijnana is made up of two parts. Vi means to divide. And jnana means to know. So it's knowing which divides things. And so some people like to call it discriminating wisdom. But discrimination has a kind of bad connotation in English. So then one scholar likes the word discernment, because it has a kind of meaning, discernment, the same kind of meaning, divided knowing, or to clearly know the distinction between things. So it said that sanya is a kind of knowing which lumps things together, understands how things are. Like if I look at you, I can see you're a woman. So, you know, I lumped you together with all other women. But my discriminating wisdom is that which separates me. I see you as, you know, someone wearing glasses. I can start making distinctions between, and you're wearing a different color than the woman next to you in your clothes. So start making distinctions. And that's a function of vijnana, is to see how things are separate from everything else, to make distinctions from the big buzzing confusion of sensations that go on, as opposed to understanding the commonality of, you know, of categories. So that's kind of a technical definition, which kind of in people's minds kind of can start getting confused and checking out, I guess. Some people will translate vijnana as knowing. And it has a quality of knowing something. So it's knowingness, that part of the mind that knows. But that's not quite that accurate either. But the word, English word consciousness is so vague in what we mean by it. You can say popularly, locally, you know, I'm conscious of this paper, I'm conscious that we're running late. You know, it means I know it. But consciousness has a whole other range of meaning than what it might mean. So to translate a Pali word, the English word consciousness, then lends itself to a lot of sloppiness. So vijnana is translated as consciousness often, but it might not be really accurate to do it. Shugyam Trungpa translated it as discriminating wisdom. Someone else, as I said, translated as discernment. I think the Thai horse fish is sometimes translated as knowing.
So this is the word that is in one of the five aggregates?
Yes.
And so that discriminative wisdom is impermanent and suffering and not so. Thank you.
So, enjoy your mindfulness. And I hope this was a little, you know, pep talk for it. Anyway, thank you.